So thank you all for coming, and we are going to jump right in. I'm going to share my screen, which has the which has all the sources. So okay, let's do this. Okay, so you should now all see a my let me just do two little things. There we go. Okay. You should all see my text here, which is from the website Al Torah that has the text of the book and the translation. There are some tabs at the top, which will include a tab of the source page that I had prepared for today, which is also in the, linked in the chat. We spent last week, we spent some time looking at the introduction to Daniel, the historical background, Jehoiakim, the exile of the first steps into the Babylonian experience under Nebuchadnezzar. This is before the temple is destroyed. Jehoiakim dies on the way, or is unclear, but certainly the end of the rebellion. Nebuchadnezzar comes, puts the rebellion down, takes some of the kalim, some of the vessels of the temple to Babel. That theme of the vessels of the temple will come back to us much later in the book. And now we're kind of zeroing in or looking more closely at the experience of the Jews as they take their first steps to Babel, and about a decade or so before the destruction of the temple and the second wave of the exile that comes thereafter. Vayomer HaMelech, starting with Pasuk Gimel. Vayomer HaMelech LaAshpenaz. Rav Sarisav, king spoke to Ashpenaz, Rav Sarisav, there are certain titles that are common to officers of the court of the king, whether it be in Egypt, whether it be in Babel, Suis Paro, Rav Sarasim, we'll see later in the book, Rav Tabachim, which is similar to the story by Yosef. These are officers in the court. Lehavi mibnei Yisrael umizera hamelucha umin apar temim. Yiladim asher ein behem kol mum v'tovei mareh u'maskilim b'kol chochma v'yodei da'at u'mevinei mada. To bring, have to be careful about sentence structure. Sentence structure in our language, sentence can sometimes carry across multiple psukim in Tanakh, and vice versa. Sometimes you can have a pasuk with multiple sentences. What we call a sentence and what Tanakh refers to as a pasuk is not necessarily the same, but that's just a parenthetical aside. In this case, to bring from amongst the children of Israel and royal seed and nobles, children, Yiladim, gathered together from amongst all of those who have come into exile, special children, children who stand out. How do they stand out? Asher ein behem komum, they have no blemish, they're handsome, tovei mar'eh, they're fair to look upon, maskilim, they are skilled, or they are successful, b'chol chochma, da'at, bina, these are phrases that should jump off the page, in all matters of wisdom, knowledge, and understanding, mevinei mada, v'asher koach behem la'amod b'chal ha'melech, strong, that can stand in the court of the king, ulelamdam sefer ulashon kazdim. And these young children will undergo an education in the language and culture and the books of the Chaldeans, of the Babylonians. So Nebuchadnezzar begins a process of education and acculturation, some would say indoctrination, language, for all of these children, wise, intelligent, special, cadre, the cream of the crop, amongst the children who have come into exile. And v'yiman lehem ha'melech t'vayom b'yomo, and every day the king would appoint for them, or give a portion to them, mipatbag ha'melech, portion of the king's food, u'miyen mishtav, and a portion of the king's drink, u'legadlam shalosh shanim, and to raise them there in this process for 3 years, and then amongst them the chosen ones, the successful ones, those who graduate with honors from this kind of educational program, they will come and stand before the king. Vayibahem ibne Yehuda, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Va'azaya. And amongst them from these children were four Judeans by the name of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Va'azaya. And that is our first introduction to Daniel and his friends, as it is referred to, Daniel v'chaverav, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Vayasim lehem sar sarisim shemot. And amongst the things that the officer did is he gave them new names. Can't be in the court of the king with a name like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, Judean names. And so he gives them Babylonian names. Vayasim le Daniel Belshazzar. Daniel is called Belshazzar. Hananiah is called Shadrach. Mishael is called Meshach. And Azariah is called Avednego. That's the program. The remainder of the perek deals with how Daniel and his friends would cope with this kind of regimen. And we'll explore that, Bezrat Hashem, either in the second half today or next week. I just want to come back to this program for a second and understand what exactly Nebuchadnezzar is trying to accomplish in this kind of regimen. Takes children, yiladim she'en behem komum, handsome children, good stock, good genes, as they would call them, intelligent, and bring them into the temple, teach them lashon kazdim, Babylonian language, lamdam sefer, to teach them the book learning, the culture and the science and the history and the education of the Chaldeans, of the Babylonians, to eat of the king's food and drink of the king's drink, and for 3 years to grow up in this kind of experience of the palace of the king. To what end is Nebuchadnezzar's attempt or effort here? What is the goal? So I think it's fairly self-evident. Not a lot of rocket science here. But it's an interesting, I think fascinating, insight into the mindset of Nebuchadnezzar. We typically think of the Babylonians or Nebuchadnezzar as kind of this conquering army to go and devastate and conquer as many lands as possible, and to, you know, Nebuchadnezzar eventually will destroy the temple, and exile the king and exile the people and sort of Nebuchadnezzar the conqueror. But this is a very different kind of experience here. And these young children are invited into a special status, to go into the palace of the king, to eat the royal food, and to receive a royal and special education and learning and language and skills, and really to be treated almost like royalty. It's quite the treat. But it's not an accident, and it's very targeted, and it's very intentional. I'll share with you how the Malbim puts it, not surprisingly. And the Malbim kind of explains this program as follows. Vayomer HaMelech, the king commanded to bring these children. I have to translate this one because I couldn't find a readily available English translation, so I'm just going to translate this on the fly. Tzival lavi yoladim ben min ha'amon, he commanded to bring children, whether those children gathered from the masses, mibnei Yisrael, as it says, right, from the children of Israel, or from the noble, from the seed of nobility, whether it be from the royal family or other nobles amongst the Jews, ben min ha'gdolim mizera ha'mulucha. And his intent was, ratzashi amdu lefanav, chalek l'kol achad avodah, and he would give each one their task. What would be their task? So from the sea, those who had royal blood would stay within the palace. But more importantly for our purposes, mibnei ha'sarim, amongst those who were brought into this experience, yamdu liyot sarim acharei zeh b'yuda. They would then, after they've been educated in Bavel, educated in the palace, educated in the language of the Babylonians, educated in the books and in the culture and the history of the Babylonian experience, these young children would then grow up to be ambassadors. But as ambassadors of the message of Bavel to the Jews in Judah, nichna'im tachdav, their loyalty would be to Bavel. Yodim nimusei kazdim, they would learn the culture of the Babylonians, l'shonam, their language. And then the rest of them, they would also serve in various capacities of the Babylonian experience. In other words, what we have here is a fascinating psychological and sociological experiment, is not an effort to conquer a land militarily and physically, but an effort to acculturate, to indoctrinate, to instill into these youngest generation a sense of what it means, Babylonian pride, Babylonian language, Babylonian culture, and then send them home. Then send them back. Send them into the Jewish community. Send them back to the Jewish community in the land of Israel or in Babel. They would become the greatest conveyors of Babylonian loyalty. And to guarantee, or to, in a sense, to reduce any potential for opposition, for rebellion, for resistance, you take the youngest and the brightest and the best, and you give them all that the Babylonian experience has to offer. It's quite a education, chinuch, and talk about all the values that we think about when you talk about in the Jewish community. We talk about how central the role of education is from the youngest age. Here you have a biblical experience that says, you're right, the education is the key to identity and loyalty and connectedness and national identity and religious identity. It all starts from the education from the youngest age. And what's the proof? That's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar does. So he takes these children, Chochma, Bina, Vedat, children, young, wise, intelligent, and he teaches them all the pieces of the Babylonian experience.
Is it a coincidence? Is there a link in verse 5 with the what he feeds them, which is not lechem min hashamayim, and manna by Yaman and Mipat?
Interesting. Vayiman simply means to appoint, so I don't know.
No, I know, but we do have word plays. We don't have to have one.
Yeah, I don't know that it's connected to the man. We'll see the patbag, which is the daily portion of food, will become a major theme in the rest of the parak. That's clearly not coming from Shemaim. Maybe you could make the argument that it's sort of the opposite contrast to the man. It's possible. I haven't seen an address to that link, but it's certainly possible. That's part one of this Babylonian experience: language, education, culture. Part two of this indoctrination, or I'll call it a program of assimilation, which is essentially what's going on. It's a program of systematic assimilation of this new Judean exile, and I assume, by extension, that thus was his practice with most nations that came under their wing, was to give them new names. And so he renames all of these children, and in this case, for our purposes, he names Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah with Babylonian names, Belshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And that, too, is not new to us. We've seen this process of sort of powers or royal or kings or other authorities renaming or giving names to those who come under their service. Rashi makes the observation, I'll just jump to Rashi for a moment, that Belshazzar is a name of a Babylonian deity, Al Shem Avadat Kochavim, named Bel, as it refers to in in Perek Dalet, Belshazzar, Dishmei Belshazzar Kishum Elahi. His name is Belshazzar, referring to Daniel, like the name of my God, says Daniel. So the notion of these, they weren't just Babylonian names, they were in fact names of deities, names of Babylonian deities. And the Mefarshim kind of identify for each of them how they end up with this kind of Babylonian religious name, Shadrach, Abednego, etc. But you can see in that process too, Vayasim Lahem Sarasarasim, these names were given to them. It wasn't like they chose Babylonian names, right? They were given these names, and they are referred to by these names through the rest of the Sefer, although, and this will become a theme we'll look at several times, there's a little bit of tension with these names. Nebuchadnezzar names them, but every once in a while we hear that Daniel, whose name was Belshazzar, or Daniel, who the king called Belshazzar. A little bit of tension as to how they saw themselves by their original Hebrew name, or by this new Babylonian name that was imposed on them. That's one piece of the story. The other piece of the story is not just what they are named, but who names them. Ve'yasim lahem sarasarisim shemot. It is the sarasarisim who is giving them these names, who is saying to them, you shall be known now by a Babylonian name, not by your Hebrew name. That's part of this acculturation, part of this effort of mass assimilation, which is to kind of remove the exterior trappings of language and culture and practice and the name and integrate them into the Babylonian experience. For that, you need Babylonian names. Belshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. None of these Hebrew names, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. Right? Interesting observation. Names in Tanakh are usually, especially names that are given, or that are rebranded, if you will, very often will have the name of the deity to which one affirms their loyalty embedded in the name. So if you look at Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, right, you can see the identification of Shem Hashem embedded in their names. And so Rashi points out, and the other Mefarshim as well, that the Babylonian names follow the same practice. Belshazzar, Bel, Babylonian god, a deity, etc. In order to kind of shift that religious identity, not just a national identity, but inexorably connected to their identity of loyalty to their deity. Huh? You're in Babel now, you have to remain loyal to, you have to accept your loyalties to the Babylonian deities involved. And that becomes a source of great tension for the rest of the Sefer, because that's at the heart of what the struggle in Babel is about. So you have essentially two anchors in this moment. You have the fact that their names are changed, and you have who is it that is changing their names. In this case, it is Sarasarisim, or it is a representative of the king. Anybody besides, we've seen this pattern already. We saw it by the kings of Judah. We saw it last week when we talked about the last children of the last kings of Israel, children and grandchildren of Yoshiyahu, who were put on the throne by foreign powers, and their names were changed. So Mataniah became Tzidkiyahu, Yehoyachin became Yehoyachin. Yakim became Yehoyakim. Right? Although there, they didn't change the deity embedded in the name, but they did change their loyalty, meaning you now owe your allegiance to me, King of Babel, because I put you on the throne. So my act of giving you this name is a way of claiming your allegiance to me. And that's also what's happening here. So Paro renames, and Nebuchadnezzar play that game with renaming the kings of Israel. We see it also, who else famously was renamed by a king when he became, when he entered into the king's service?
Yosef,
exactly. So the Ibn Ezra immediately on this pasuk, Vayasim Lahem Shemot, immediately points to Kasher Kara Paro Shem Yosef Tzafnat Panech, just as Paro renamed Yosef as Tzafnat Panech, drawing our eye to that exact moment where you have a servant who enters into, a slave almost, enters into the service of the king, and the king renames them. regardless of whether it's a deity, but just the act of renaming them is a way of claiming loyalty to the one who grants that name. Names are a form of branding. They're a form of identity. And if somebody else or some other power grants me a name or rebrands my name, then they're essentially asserting their authority over me. We have a similar concept in the mitzvah of Brit Milah. Right? The Brit Milah that Abraham goes through, that's an experience of circumcision, is predicated by God coming to Abraham and changing both Abraham's name and Sarah's name. And that's why we name children at a bris, because there, it's loyalty to God. It's loyalty to the covenant with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. But it's the same principle, right? At the moment that we enter into that covenant, we accept the name as part of that identity. It's a fascinating aside. It was not really a subject for today, but just kind of open parentheses. Who is the most famous pair in Chumash that is named and renamed, if you will, is Yeshua and Moshe. Moshe renames Yehoshua. So there's a fascinating discussion in the Mefarshim what that was all about. In Parshat Shlach, by the story of the spies, the Pasuk says that Moshe called Hoshea ben Nun Yehoshua. And Rashi suggests that it has to do with the story of the spies, that Moshe was praying for him that he kind of be spared the negativity of the spies. But there are other Mefarshim, Rashbam and others, who point out that Yehoshua enters into the service of Moshe long before the story of the spies. Parshat B'Shalach, when they leave Egypt, Yehoshua is the Misharet Moshe. He is the right hand of Moshe, and he's referred to there as Yehoshua. So other Mefarshim suggest, other than Rashi, I think Rashbam, and others, that Yeshua's name is changed by Moshe the moment Yeshua enters into Moshe's service, as part of this same pattern. There it was done willingly. There it was done as an act of covet. There it was done as an act of disciple and his master, if you will, Moshe and Yeshua his Mishareh. But here it's forced upon them because they are entering into this kind of forced service of Nebuchadnezzar, and what we will explore is how well it took. Whether or in fact Daniel continues to refer to himself as Daniel or Belshazzar. Do Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah refer to themselves by their Hebrew names or by their Babylonian names? That's exactly the question we will have to explore. But it also opens up a fascinating insight into another component, which is a famous medrash, quoted in the Mefarshim by the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim. And there's a Mechilta so basically summarize what I just said before. There's a Mechilta that is quoted in various forms with regards to the story of the Exodus. By what merit did the Jews kind of earn their right to be redeemed from Egypt, so to speak? And there, Rabbi Eliezer Kapar, in the name of Rebbe, says that they had four mitzvot that essentially they held on to in all of that experience throughout the slavery in Egypt. Arba mitzvot she'en kol olam kedai behem. What are they? Shelo nechshedu ala arayot. They were not suspected of illicit relations. They kept their lineage and their purity of the family. Velo ala shon hara. They did not slander each other. They did not build up their own status at the expense of other slaves. V'lo shinu et shmam, v'lo shinu et lashonam. They didn't change their names. They didn't change their language. They kept the same language and names that they had when they came down to Egypt. And one of the questions is, where did the Mechilta come get this from? What's the source for this idea? And there's evidence in the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim itself, but the fascinating link is our experience in what we're studying in Daniel, which is that these children, you see by Daniel, the intentional effort of Nebuchadnezzar to change their language, to teach them Babylonian language, Lashon Kazdim, to change their names, to give them Babylonian names, and thereby to assimilate and acculturate them into the Babylonian experience. We'll talk about the Arayot, the family relations in, a little bit down the road in the book as well. But these are sort of the anchors of identity on an external level, right? The external, the clothes they wore, the names they spoke, that they addressed themselves as, the language or the culture that they expressed. Language is more than just whether you speak English or French or Hebrew or Yiddish. Language is a whole cultural reference. And that was part of the struggle of this first generation of Jews going to Babel. They come face to face with the great Nebuchadnezzar's enterprise, and the first thing that happens is they enter into the service of the king, forced, as young children, and they're asked to take on Babylonian names, Babylonian clothes, ostensibly, they're in the palace of the king, Babylonian names and language, and then to eat the Babylonian food. And that brings us to part two of this perek, which is the story of the food of the king and the effort to resist. So back to perek Aleph, Pasuk Zayin, Pasuk Chet. Vayasem Daniel alibo, asher lo yitga'al bepat bagamelech ubeyein mishtaf. Daniel resolved in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's food or the king's wine. And so he made a special request from the chief officer not to force him to eat this food. I'll come to the rest of it in a second, but immediately, Pasuk Zayin to Pasuk Chet highlights two things that we need to pay attention to. Sara Sarisim names Daniel Belshazzar. Next Pasuk, Vayasim Daniel Alibo. Meaning, he's referred to as Belshazzar. Abandon your Hebrew name. Now you take on a Babylonian name. Next pasuk, Daniel. And that's the tension. That whether or not that name sticks becomes a symbol. Right? It becomes a symbol in the story as to whether or not Daniel and his friends are willing to allow themselves to, remember the children, willing to allow themselves these kinds of symbols and externals as a form of assimilation, or whether they resist. And in Daniel's case, we see, and his friends as well, this is their resistance. Their resistance is, number one, they'll be referred to as their Hebrew names, and number two, they're being brought food, pat bag hamelech, whatever the word pat bag is, it's not clear what it means. We'll see that in a second. But the whatever food they're being brought, whatever drink they're drinking, comes from the king. They see it as a form of defilement. It's not, whether it's a kashrus issue or otherwise, and they refuse. Lo yitzgal, adkan, till here. Now they put the foot down. We are not going to do it. Accompanying Daniel and his friends was an element of divine mercy, compassion, chen v'chesed. The Sara Sarisim took a liking to them. V'yomer Sara Sarisim, so he turns to them and he says, to Daniel, Yerei ani et Adoni HaMelech, your request is innocuous enough, but I fear for my life from the king. Asheminat machalchem et mishtechem, who has appointed and apportioned your food and drink. Ashelama yer et penechem zoafim, if you go for 3 years without eating or drinking, it's going to happen, right? If you even survive, you will be emaciated and weak. My task is to bring you to the king healthy and strong. You will become pnechem zo'afim, your face is downcast, mina yeladim asher kegilchem, compared to other youths of your same age. Right? Just watch the program. These kids are eating and these kids are not. Well, these malnutrition and not malnutrition, malnourished and not malnourished. It's not complicated. L'chiyavtem et roshi lamelech. Who will be responsible? Whose head will he take? He'll take my head. Daniel said to the steward, by the way, this is a fascinating study of language, the words that are found only in certain books of Tanakh that end up creeping into the modern Hebrew lexicon. Maltzar is one of them. In modern Hebrew, Maltzar is a waiter. Vayomer Daniel el Maltzar, Ashemina et Shemina Sarha Sarisim al Daniel, Hanana Mishav Azaya. Daniel said to the steward who was appointed over Daniel, Hanania Mishava Azariah, so it's all four of them, and again, identified by their Hebrew name, because that's part of their resistance. Nasna Davadecha. Test us. Test us. Yamim Asara for 10 days. Vitnu lanu minha zeroim vinochla. Umayim benishta. Instead of eating bread and drinking wine, we will eat grain or seeds, and we'll drink water. And let's see what happens. And after 10 days, v'yerau lefanecha mar'enu umareha yeladim, let our appearance be seen before you, together with the appearance of other youths, and compare, and let's see what happens. Compare us to others who eat the king's food. And if you see that it's not working, so you'll force us to eat the food. And if you see that we're no worse off because we're eating grain and water and they're drinking and they're eating bread and drinking wine, so be it. So he said, it sounds like a reasonable effort, so he tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, their appearance, ma'ehem tov uvriyei basar min hayeladim ha'ochlim et pat bagamalach. They looked fairer and were fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So there was no way to say to them, oh, you can't do this because you'll be malnourished after 10 days. Here they are eating seeds and grain and water for 10 days, and they're doing just fine. So, the only problem is, who's going to eat the portion that the king assigned to these four children? Somebody's got to eat it, otherwise it's not going to go in the garbage, and they're going to realize what's afoot. So the Maltzar had a great deal with them. They would eat grain and water and drink water, and the Maltzar would eat the pat bagamelech and the wine. And guarantee you, this Maltzar was now eating better than he'd ever eaten in his life in the service of Nebuchadnezzar. Great deal. Ve'yaladim ha'ela arba'atam, natan lahem ha'elokim, mada ve'haskel. God granted these four youths great knowledge and skill, b'chol sefer, b'chochmah, in all matters of wisdom and learning. They were excelling in the curriculum provided to them by Nebuchadnezzar's officers. V'Daniel hevin b'chol chazon v'chalamot, and Daniel had a unique understanding of visions and dreams. That's a foreshadowing of what will come in the next chapter. And at the end of the days that had been designated, Ashamar HaMelech, after 3 years, Laviyam, Veviyam, Sarah, Sarasim, Wifnin, Nebuchadnezzar, they brought these youth before Nebuchadnezzar. Vaydaberet HaMelech, king spoke with them, Belonim Tzah Mikulam, Kedaniel Chanana Mishael Ba'azayat. There was none of the children, none of the other children in this regimen, whether it be Jewish children or other nations that have been conquered and acculturated in the same educational program. None of them reached the level of wisdom, understanding, insight of Daniel, Chanana, Mishael, Azayah, and therefore, v'yamdu lifnei melech, they were appointed to come and stand before the king. V'chol dvar chochmat bina, asher b'kesh mehem ha-melech, any matter of wisdom, understanding that the king sought from them, v'yimtzeim eser yadot al kol ha-chartomim ha-shafim ha-shebechom ha-chuto, they were 10 times better, wiser, more successful than all the magicians and enchanters in all of the realm of Daniel, of Nebuchadnezzar. And so they entered into the service of the king, v'hi Daniel achnat achat l'koresh ha-melech, and there Daniel served until the end of the book, until the first year of Koresh, the king of Babel, Persia, the story much, much, much later in history.
Rabbi?
That's Perek Aleph. Yes. Yes, somebody had a question. Somebody had a question? I don't know. I heard somebody call out. But before, okay. Yes.
Oh, I do have mics. How old were Daniil and his and the other three?
So we don't know exact ages, but they are described as children. So they're young. I'm going to take a guess at 8, 9, 10, 11 kind of age. Maybe they're teenagers. It's hard to describe teenagers in Tanakh as Yeladim, but it's possible. But they're not much older than that. Daniil will remain in the service until year one of Koresh, which is more or less 70 years later, give or take. So they're children. Exactly how old, we don't know. Is it conceivable that Daniil is 17 years old? It's possible. That would be ironic and very convenient. Why would that be ironic and very convenient? Because of where we're going next, which is that there's an obvious parallel between this story and another story in Tanakh that literally jumps off the page. And that is Yosef.
Yosef.
The parallels between Daniil and Yosef are famous. They are clear. There have been articles and written about it. The storyline, the young Jewish child who goes into a foreign power and has to remain loyal to his roots, loyal to his Jewish identity, even though he's surrounded by a foreign culture, Yosef in Mitzrayim, Daniel in Bavel, the king who is enamored, who is taken by the wisdom of these youths, or the power is taken by the wisdom and understanding of Yosef. Yosef interprets dreams. Daniel is described as interpreting dreams. Daniel enters into the unique service of the king because of his dream interpretation, as does Yosef. That's in chapter 2. The themes, the storyline of Yosef as a child entering into the service of the king and rising to a position of power is strikingly parallel to the story of Daniel. That's not an accident, and we will explore over the course of time what that parallel means for us. For now, we're just going to leave it as it's there, and we'll come back to it. But I also want to highlight the fact that there's a textual parallel here as well. Because not only is it thematic stories that link the two, but there are phrases that jump off the page here that are clearly references that we are familiar with from the story of Yosef. As an example, take a look at, let's take a look at Pasuk Tetvav. After 10 days, the children appeared before the king, Marehem Tov Uvriye Basar. Good looking in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the other children. That phrase should...
Halom Paro.
That's exactly what the dream of Paro was. We saw all of those cows, Yafot Mareu Briot Basar, these beautiful fat cows emerging from the Nile together with the lean, skinny other cows. Now, in this case, we're not talking about cows, we're talking about children, but you have, right? You have beautiful, fat, sort of healthy-looking children and emaciated-looking, comparing children, children in comparison, compared to the dreams. And if you follow that line of language parallel, there's a small chart here, and again, I didn't include the translation, I apologize, I just wanted you to see the language pieces. Phrases such as Daniel, the Sar HaSarisim says to Daniel, why should we see your faces downtrodden? Lama yu'epnechem zo'afim, when compared to the other children, if I only feed you seed or grain. That was exactly what Yosef saw in the other prisoners in the prison when he says to them in the morning, Vayarotam inam zo'afim. And they were sad, right? The Sarah Mashkim and the Sarah Ofin, the baker and the butler, right? They were in that jail. And they were sad, they were distraught, they were worried, they were concerned. And you could see it on their faces, but the language there, Panim Zo'afim, is the same. I already showed you the parallel of Marehem Tov Uvriye Basar, which is referred to in Paro's dream. The notion that Daniel was successful because God's presence was with him. Vayiten Elokim Daniel lechesed ulerachamim. He gave him a kind of compassion and mercy and chen that the Sarasim took a liking to him. That too is a parallel to Yosef, where God's presence, Vayhi Hashem et Yosef, God was with Yosef, and therefore he had a sense of chesed and chen that accompanied him to wherever he went. These children are described as Tovei Mar'eh, which is exactly the same language as described Yosef. Yosef was Yefei Tohar, Yefei Mar'eh, was handsome. And in the end, Daniel and his friends enter into the service of the king because there is none other, lo nimtza mikulam, no other person there in that kingdom, or amongst those children, had the same kind of dvar chokhmat bina, the kind of chokhmah and bina, that wisdom and understanding that Daniel and his friends had. It's exactly the same language Yosef, Paro uses to describe Yosef's uniqueness. Ein navon v'chacham kamocha. There is none as wise and understanding as you. And therefore he enters into the service of the king. So the language parallel, the content, the storyline, the striking similarities between Yosef and Daniel are very clear, including the need to resist the acculturation of the time, to remain loyal to the roots of Jewish identity that are the core of the story. The whole essence of the story here is Daniel and his friends resisting the bread and the wine and the kashrus challenges that being in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar posed for them, as was, we'll see a little bit in a few moments, similar to the story of Yosef. So there is a striking parallel in regards to the experience that Yosef and Daniel find themselves in, and that parallel we will continue to explore, and the Farshim pick up on it, the Medrash picks up on it. It's not hard to see it in the next chapter when Nebuchadnezzar has a dream and none of his advisors can tell him the meaning of the dream except Daniel. Right? That story is so strikingly similar that it jumps off the page.
Can I just say a comment here?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Eating this zeronim is very smart because every zera has in it all what the whole plant is. And actually, I can recommend it because I'm doing it. I'm eating zeronim every day, you know. It's healthy. It has everything in it.
I appreciate that. I would only raise one question. I'm not 100% sure. I could be wrong. I'm not 100% sure that Daniel and his friends knew that. I suspect strongly that they did not.
Because it makes sense. It
makes sense to us because our knowledge of nutrition is very different. To them, even the language for healthy in Tanakh is briei basar, which means fat. Today, you would not call somebody fat healthy. But in the language of Tanakh, fat was translated as healthy. I'm not sure that they knew that much about what they were asking. They did know that this was food that did not have any potential danger. And that's the question, or spiritual concern. And that's the question I want to raise, which is what was wrong with the king's food? Let's assume for the moment they didn't understand that water and seed would keep them healthy and alive. I'm going to assume for a moment they did not have that knowledge. They're putting their lives on the line because they're going to go for 10 days without drinking. Remember, water was not something that you drank regularly in the time of Tanakh. You couldn't get clean water. The standard form of drink was not water, it was wine. You didn't drink water as a kind of a nutritional hydration supplement. You drank wine. And you ate food, bread and meat. So in the context of Daniel, refusing to drink the wine and refusing to eat the bread was putting their lives in danger for what seems to be a somewhat of an innocuous kashrus issue. What was wrong with eating the king's bread or the king's food?
What I think...
It doesn't say, and we'll come to it, hang on a second. It doesn't say that it was meat. It says patbag, which is not clear what it is. And we could translate it as bread, but that's not necessarily so clear. Pat in Aramaic is bread, but whether or not that's the reference here, so it could be that it's referring to some sort of food. What was wrong with the wine? Unclear. So the Mefarshim suggest that there was much more here than just a function of kashrus. And I think intuitively we are kind of jumped on that piece as well. I'm just going to go back up to the sources. So with regards to this patbag, Rashi, for example, says that it was the word patbag is a Persian or a Babylonian or Chaldean name for the king's food, Shem Achal HaMelech. On the other hand, by and of itself, that leaves us with this question. So what's wrong with eating the king's food? We live in a world where food industry is so complex that everything has to have a hechsher in order to be kosher. In the world of Tanakh, that's not necessarily the case, right? You don't have food processing. You have meat, fish, and vegetables. So your meat and your fish have certain issues with them, but your vegetables do not. That's essentially it's a simple kashrus issue, maybe. But kashrus is not one of the big three for which everyone has to put their life on the line if in violation. So the Ibn Ezra suggests that the patbag HaMelech was prohibited, and the wine as well, because they were used in linaschale lemishpatam lelayhem, used in some sort of religious ceremony, some kind of libation service of their deities. In other words, says the Ibn Ezra, this isn't a kashrus issue. What is it?
It's an avodah zarah.
It's an avodah zarah. Right. And that's the approach that most of the Mefarshim take, is to see some element of this food being tainted by the cultural identity to the deities of Bava. Whether it was because the wine was being used in that context, whether it was because the food was being used in that context, the Mitzvah David, Asher Lo Yitka'el, the language Daniel uses, is not that he doesn't want to eat non-kosher food, he doesn't want to be defiled by this food. Lo Yitga'el b'patbag HaMelech. And that because of its identity with Avodat Kochavim Umazalot, says the Mitzvah David, you have that, and the Malbim similarly says, Yichedoto l'avodat elilim, that this food was designated to the purpose of idolatry, Mizivchei Meitim, B'yei Nischehem, offering food, bread, meat that was used in some sort of sacrificial service, or wine that was used as some sort of libation ceremony. Right? That's essentially what they argued, that there was an element of idolatry in this food. Because kashrus by in itself is not a... Right? You don't have to put your life on the line for kashrus. We see it all the time. Right? People who are, for example, who are ill and they have to go into a hospital and they can't get kosher food, but their life is on the line, they can eat the non-kosher food because kashrus is not one of the big three. Avodah Zarah is. So the Mefarshim are bothered by the notion that Daniel and his friends would resist just on the basis of kashrus. There had to have been some other element here that expands this resistance beyond just food and into the domain of food tainted by idolatry. In the Gemara, there's a fascinating observation that sees this issue on a different level. The Gemara, it's actually Gemara in Masechet Avodah Zarah, says the following. We have no evidence that this food of the king or wine of the king was in fact used in libation or sacrificial services. We have no evidence to that. So why would he resist? Why would Daniel and his friends resist its use? So here we have, says the Gemara, the first introduction of rabbinic decrees. or fences around the Torah. These are the things that the rabbis prohibited because they come from non-Jewish sources. And they are include pat v'shemen, bread and oil. You've heard of the prohibition of pat akum or bishul akum, right? Food cooked by Gentile, bread made by Gentile bakers. Right? These are rabbinic restrictions. They're not biblical prohibitions. They're only biblically prohibited if they're actually used in libation services or in sacrificial ceremony. Here we're not. We're talking about, we have no evidence that they were used in that fashion. But they come from non-Jewish sources. And the oil is kind of connected to the wine, is related to the notion of drink. The Hashemen Shalahem, says the Gemara, where do we know that that was prohibited? Rav Amar Daniel Gazar Alav. Because Daniel made such a decree. Shmuel disagrees. What's the position of Rav? Daniel refused to eat the bread of the king and the wine of and its drink. So the Gemara darshens two mishta'ot, shtei mishta'ot, two types of drink, wine and oil. And this Gemara's conclusion, and Rashi there makes the observation that Daniel made the initial decree mishum chatnut. We have this notion that the purpose of these decrees, that these prohibitions against the bread and the cooking and the wine, even if it's not used in libation services, is because the kind of mingling, social mingling that this would create would lead to, as they say, intermarriage. That's the language that Rashi uses. What's essentially going on? Let's take a step back from the Gemara. How did Chazal see in Daniel's behavior a decree against bread and oil and wine of Gentile sources? Because, as Rashi says, there would be a concern about social mingling that would lead to intermarriage. What is the connection there? So here I think the answer is by taking a step back from the text and the language and the nuance for a second and looking at the experience. Put yourselves into the shoes of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. Let's give him an age. 15. Somebody asked me before how old they are. 15, 17. Young children. Enter into Babylonian experience. They enter into the palace of the king. They're forced into a Babylonian educational program. They're taught Babylonian customs, Babylonian language, Babylonian science and history, Babylonian loyalty, social studies, science. They're given Babylonian names. By the end of their educational program, 3 years down the road, what element of Jewish identity would be left in these poor kids? Could they even identify themselves as Judean? Or would they have become so acculturated into the world above all that you wouldn't be able to identify them as Jews at all? They don't look like Jews anymore. They don't talk like Jews anymore. Their language is Babylonian. Their names are Babylonian. Their dress is Babylonian. That's exactly what the Gemara identifies as what didn't happen to the Jews in Egypt. It's suddenly being forced upon these young children in Bavel. Where's the line in the sand?
Maybe circumcision?
Interestingly, circumcision doesn't appear in the context of the book. It's an interesting question. Maybe because it was too hidden for it to be identifiable, right? We're talking about externals. It becomes an issue much later in the Greek arena, in the story of Hanukkah, because the Greeks extolled the virtue of the gymnasiums and the nude. So it was open, it was clear for people to see. But in the world of Babylonian, that's not the case. So it's too hidden even to remain an identifiable issue. Where would be the line in the sand for that?
So possibly there was still community that they occasionally met with.
Maybe.
Who had not acculturated.
Maybe. We don't know. They're growing up in the palace. It's possible. Doesn't tell us. But for them, the line in the sand is the food they eat. That to them is the symbol of the last remnant of Jewish separateness from the world of the Babylonians. The lo yitga'al bepat bagamelech, not to be defiled with the king's bread and wine. And that the Gemara sees as the foundation of all of those rabbinic decrees, patakum, bishalakum, all of those rabbinic decrees are essentially what Rashi describes as there to separate the social interactions with the non-Jews. That's essentially at the core of it. But there's a fascinating, this whole connection creates a fascinating source for one of the most esoteric comments in Rashi in Bereishit. Remember we talked about Yosef. Yosef faced exactly the same issue. Yosef is sitting in Paro's palace. Yosef is given all the keys to the palace. He finds favor in everybody's eyes. In the house of Potiphar, he is second to none. And then we find the following text. I have 1 second left. I have 1 minute left. I'll show you something. We find the following conversation. Yosef, the pasuk says in Perek Lamed Tet, Ve'azov kol ha'shalom b'yad Yosef. Potiphar left all that he had in the hands of Yosef. V'lo yaday tom umah. He said, Yosef, you're in charge. I don't want to know about anything. Ki im alechem asher hu ochel. The only thing that Paro left, the Potiphar, did not put in Yosef's hands, was the bread he ate. And Rashi says that the bread he ate is a euphemism for his wife. Why? Because look at the next verse. When Eshet Potiphar challenges Yosef, the language of the pasuk is identical. V'lo chasach mimeni meuma, he has not. Yosef says to Eshet Potiphar, God, that the Potiphar, your master, has not left me, has not held back anything from me. Nobody is greater than me in the household. I'm not withheld from anything. Ki im otach ba'asher at ishto, with the exception of you, as far as you being his wife. It's the same language as in pasuk Vav. But what you have in the story of Daniel is, okay, if at the age of 17 or 20, in this case a couple of years later, at the age of 20, young, handsome Yosef in the world of Eshet Potiphar, that's the temptation, is the wife of Potiphar, that same temptation to the young children, Daniel and his friends, we're going to talk about as what the food they eat. But the message is the same. There needs to be a line in the sand by which you say, okay, I can enter into the service of Paro, I can work in Babel, I can look like a Babylonian, I can even talk like a Babylonian, I can sing like a Babylonian, I can wear the same clothes as a Babylonian, but at the end of the day, I am not Babylonian. I am Jewish. I have my limits. Something has to be a flag I raise that says, even in the world of Bavel, even in the world of Paro and Mitzrayim, even in the world of this cultural experience that is at its core antagonistic to everything I identify, you can impose on me Babylonian names, dress, and experience. I will draw a line in the sand. And the line that I draw in the sand in the world of Yosef, that's the world of the arias, the temptation of the lineage that Chazal talk about, the Jews in Egypt having preserved their lineage, the yichus, arayot, in the world of Daniel, it's described as having preserved the food that he ate and the identity of I'm a Jew, something I do because I'm Jewish and not because you forced me to become Babylonian. That will become a theme. It will grow as the book progresses. It will mature as Daniel and his friends mature. But what to Yosef as a young adult is the temptation of Potiphar, to Daniel and his friends as young children is the temptation of the food that's being put in front of them. And that's why I think Chazal saw the connection between these two in that experience.
Hamavdil ben Kodesh l'chol. The chol is the line in the sand.
Yeah, there you go. Excellent. that's our introduction. That's our introduction to Yosef and his friends. And that's their experience in the house of Bavel as young children. By the time we turn the page to chapter 2, which is we'll start next week, suddenly they're now the young adults, and they're in the service of the king, and now the experience is going to grow and become much more sophisticated and much more in line with the kind of the classic stories that we're familiar with. Just fascinating to me that the chapter 1 begins with Daniel and his friends as children, and take the struggles we have with identity versus assimilation as adults, translate it into the domain of these children in the service of the Babylonian enterprise, and that's what you have in chapter 1.
We have to keep in mind that Daniel had already the information and what occurred to Yosef and what he went through.
Correct.
Or whoever wrote the book, Daniel, had this in front of him.
For sure. I think the Yosef's experience is a role model for them. No question.
Mm.
No question.
It's also, I don't have it in front of me, but a pasuk in the Yosef narrative, that as much as he was powerful and integrated into the society, he still ate separately.
Yes.
And that was at the behest of the Egyptians, as I recall.
Correct. Because they ate meat. It was an abomination to break bread with the Egyptians. Correct. So it's sort of you see the flip side here, where part of that acculturation is to eat our food and eat with us, right? You see the difference of 1,000 years that 1,000 years will make. Okay.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate your time and thank you for coming. And we will, Bezrat Hashem, continue hopefully next week.
Thank Rabbi Shulman, you might want to take a look through the chat and see if there's anything. There were many messages in the chat if you want to scroll through.
Okay.
Also, somebody named G6 who has had a raised hand for quite some time. I don't know if they want to unmute and ask their question.
Are they still online? Very hard for me to follow the chat and the hands while I'm teaching.
I don't know if there's questions, but there were some things in the chat, maybe mostly comments. But if you want to take a quick peek, and I don't know who G6 is. Your hand is raised. Maybe you have a question if you want to unmute. I don't know.
You know what? Can you save the chat? And then I will look through it. And
yes, the chat is saved along with the recording, so you'll be able to look at that.
And if there are questions that I haven't answered, I'll try to address them next week.
Excellent.
Okay.
Okay, thank you so much.
Excellent.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. And Rabbi Shulman does generally he's online 10 minutes before the start of class. So if you did post a question in the chat and you wanted to clarify anything before the beginning of next week's class, you can meet us here online a few minutes early. Okay?
Great.
Thanks, Rabbi. Everybody.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi Shulman. Very good. Very interesting.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Insightful. Wow.